Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We are Zooming this show, but we're Zooming it at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning in order for us to be as au courant as possible. As you have come to expect every single day since March, we started with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I promised you that would end on Election Day. Therefore, it has ended. But we are starting a new sort of interesting opening. I have a fabulous professor who has been posting these very, very hilarious and sometimes tragic political limericks on my Facebook page. I reached out to him and I said, will you be my Calvin Trillin? And for those of you who may not know this, Calvin Trillin writes these fabulous sort of political verse for The Nation magazine. My professor, who's going to be remaining unnamed at this point, his initials are ST, is that as Calvin Trillin is to The Nation, ST is to The Attitude. Political verse for the times we live in. Here is our first limerick. We stayed up for his angry speech. He declared his big win with a breach. As votes are being counted, his legal challenges will be mounted to erase votes with judicial bleach. And that begins our first limerick. Joining us is a fabulous panel of guests. They come from all over the country, which makes them even more perfect. And I want to introduce them, and I will do this fairly quickly. We have Annalise Orlick. She's a professor of history, Jewish studies, and women's gender and sexuality studies at Dartmouth College. You have a new book, or came out at least within the last year or so. And Annalise, can you share with my audience the title of that book? Because I think to a large extent, it also will explain a little bit about what they're going to be hearing coming out of you.
My most recent book is entitled, We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. And indeed, there are some issues from last night that are relevant to that topic.
Totally. Also joining us, and I'm going to just sort of go around the horn, is Val Endres. She's a political communication professor at Rhode Island College. She was up, I think, covering last night's election in Rhode Island with a lot of folks. She has run focus groups and debate watch sessions with the Commission on Presidential Debates. And I want to welcome Val to the program. Thank you for joining us, Val.
Thank you very much, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. Stephen Pimper is a professor at UNH Manchester. He's a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. He is a nationally recognized expert on poverty, homelessness, and U.S. social policy. He is a regular on our show, and I'm really glad to have him back. And of course, you are located in New Hampshire, so you may have to do some of that heavy lifting. Thank you, Stephen.
Good morning, Arnie.
Will Wilkinson is a vice president for research at the Niskanen? Now you pronounce it for me. I always get it wrong. Will, forgive me.
Niskanen
Center, overseeing the center's research and publications. His policy work centers on domestic, social, and economic policy, with a particular focus on economic growth, social insurance, criminal justice reform, and issues around the measurement of freedom, equality, and happiness. He's a former U.S. politics correspondent for The Economist. Thank you so much for joining us, Will.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Where do you reside? What is your home? In what state?
Iowa.
Oh, this is even more perfect. All right. I guess what I'm going to do first is sort of go around the horn, asking you to sort of give me your reactions to last night. I don't know if any of you went to sleep. I think I had about an hour of sleep, not enough to sort of even pull my ideas together. But I saw something at Politico that I just sort of wanted to sort of throw out there before I introduce all of you and get your thoughts. And it was a headline that read, America is eerily retracing Rome's steps to a fall. Will it turn it around before it's too late? That was the headline of Politico this morning. All right, I'm going to start with you, Annalise Orlick from Vermont. What did you think? Were you prepared for last night? What's your reaction to last night? And how did it trickle down in Vermont politics, if at all?
Okay. I was not prepared for last night. I was surprised. I thought the overwhelming turnout in advance of the actual election day foreshadowed a different result. But I think these are the things that I'm left with. One is, whatever happens ultimately to Biden, this is the third time in the 21st century that winning the popular vote in a presidential race will not be enough. I think secondly, we can't pretend that Trumpism has been rejected soundly. It's been embraced, in fact, by about half of the country. Third, I think voter suppression in all kinds of different ways. And I'm thinking of the federal judge order that the post office looked for missing ballots in 27 postal districts, and the postal service announcing they weren't going to listen to the judge's order. So the flouting of democratic norms taking place right in the context of the election. Fourth, that the politics of resentment really affects people's brains. It's addictive, it's infectious. And I think it moves people to vote in certain ways completely separate from policy. And I think that that's part of what happened. In Vermont, we had a very strange mix, as in New Hampshire, right? Vermont voted 2-1 for Biden and 3-1 for to reelect its Republican governor, Phil Scott. And so I think that is another story about New England politics and why in Massachusetts, right? Why in Maine is Susan Collins perhaps heading to a victory? There is this particularity to New England politics and this affection for a split government that I can't honestly say I understand. It's real.
I just want to comment first about the point that they ignored the federal judge who ordered the sweep of the post office. I did an interview with a ProPublica reporter. They told me that in places like Oregon and Colorado, where they do mail-in voting, they've been doing it for years, it is pro forma to do a sweep. Yeah, of the post office. It's what they've been doing for years. They have a working relationship with their post office because they expect them to come in and check and make sure that there's nothing left on the table. So the decision by the post office to say no to this judge is really the opposite of what they have been doing for really years in other places around the country where this is the norm. So as soon as I heard that, I started screaming because I'm like, wait a minute. What happened in Colorado? What happened in Oregon? This is how they do it. It's worked perfectly well, and it's ensured the integrity of the result, number one. Number two, on the sort of the split decision, what I want to remind everyone with your Republican governor in Vermont is that I believe he did not endorse Donald Trump. Am I correct?
Yes, and he ultimately voted for Biden, but didn't say so till Election Day.
Right, and if you look in Massachusetts, the Republican governor in Massachusetts did not endorse Donald Trump. We, however, did elect a Republican governor in New Hampshire who did endorse Donald Trump, despite the fact that Biden won fairly successfully. All right, let me turn to Rhode Island now. Boy, Valandris, the story that popped off my page was your Speaker of the House. But first, I want your reaction to sort of the results at the top of the ticket and what you saw happening around the country.
A couple of takeaways, actually some very different ones, I think. First of all, I think that the polling industry needs an overhaul. There were systemic polling errors, both on the state level and on the national level. And I think part of this has to do with the polling specialists being able to weight certain groups. And they do that in order to get a representative sampling. But I think that their perspective on these groups are stereotypical. And I think one of the problems is, for example, they looked at Latinx in Florida the same way that they would look at the Latinx population in Arizona or in Texas. And this is not a monolithic group. And so I think one of the things that they're going to have to do is to truly dig in and talk to the voters. I think to be a pollster these days, you've got to interact with that group. You have to understand, and we know one of the fundamental problems in Florida was that they didn't understand the Miami-Dade Latinx group. And that led to all kinds of problems.
Can I just stop you there for a second, Val? How did you not know the Cubans? I understand what you're saying, that we have to sort of reevaluate how we poll. At what point in time do you pay attention to something that is almost, you can almost take judicial notice of? Cubans are very different from Mexicans. They're very different from Puerto Ricans. They're very powerful. They've been around for a long time. They've actually acquired a lot of wealth because they usually brought their wealth with them from Cuba. And that's what they've done. That's why, as you say this, I guess as someone who, you know, is in political communication and probably has worked more with pollsters than me, I don't get, are they just in a rut and not capable of taking notice of the changes? Or I think that's
part of the problem, or that, you know, it's so, for example, what we heard this time was about white suburban women. And we tended to lump groups by gender as well. And that leads us to all kinds of difficulties. So does other races. If you look at the Black population, for example. And in Florida, what happened is that the Trump administration understood that group far better. And because he was an incumbent, they worked with that group, and they understood that group. And the radio ads were anti-socialist radio ads, which appealed to them. And the Democrats didn't treat them that way. They thought that they had the Latinx vote because of what had been happening with kids in cages and with immigration kinds of issues. But this is a very different population that they simply did not understand. The second takeaway that I would have is that money seems to matter less. You know, we saw just tremendous amounts of money spent on this election, and it didn't seem to make the kind of difference that we thought it would. That's another issue. The other one, I think, is one that there's a seismic problem here on down ballot. I don't think the media is actually paying enough attention to this. If we look at the House may get a couple of gains, that's a huge surprise, and that was a problem with polling. But we're looking at a Senate that may be still in the hands of Mitch McConnell. And that's going to strap, if Biden pulls out this win, that's going to strap him in throughout his, at least until the midterm elections. And what the other thing that I noticed from the results last night is that the state legislators aren't flipping to the Dems as they thought. And this has huge implications.
Are you sure that's the case? Yeah, Annalise and I are both nodding our heads because I don't think that that's the case. In fact, no, I think what's happening is that you're seeing an adjustment back in that, you know, the split government you were talking about. It seems like, I don't know what happened in Texas. Does anyone know what happened in Texas? Did the Democrats did not take that? They were looking to take the House of Representatives because of that enormous turnout, and they didn't. And what is so tragic about this, in some ways I would have been a bottom up supporter, is that this is the census year. That means that redistricting is happening. If there was time to focus on the bottom of the ticket, this is the time that if you're going to spend all that money, you don't spend it on Senate races. You spend it on little, you know, House of Representative races in states around the country. So really quickly, Val, what happened in Rhode Island? Because that was just shocking.
Yes, it was a huge change in leadership. And the Speaker of the House is considered the most powerful politician in the state. And usually it's the governor, right? But not in Rhode Island. And ironically, it was a Republican woman who unseated him, but that will probably allow for increased progressive power. On top of that, we have, if Biden gets elected, then our governor may very well go to work in that administration. So if that's the case, the two most powerful people in Rhode Island, we're going to see a change. And everybody was waiting for 2022, where most of the state offices were up for re-election. And I don't think that we really saw this coming in the way that it happened.
Wow, it's amazing. So the removal of the Speaker of the House by a Republican actually opens a door for progressives in Rhode Island. Don't you love politics? I mean, it's so a chess game. All right, Will from Iowa, as well as from your political perspective here, give us your sense. And again, give people a little bit of your sort of bio other than The Economist and the center you run. When I found you because I saw some of the work that you had done with some Cato people and from a sort of a little bit of a libertarian take, which I totally value because I married a libertarian atheist Republican. So it was like, oh, Will, give me sort of your understanding of what's going on through the lens of sort of your political spectrum.
That's kind of a difficult question. Through my political perspective has, you know, shifted a lot over the last few years. Donald Trump has radicalized me as he has a lot of people. I've been distressed throughout the election season that a lot of my former libertarian colleagues and friends have been not that worried about the president's assaults on democracy. They've been, you know, participating in protests against shutdown orders in states that are having difficulties with the coronavirus. Some of them are like, you know, rah-rah to the militia dudes who show up outside state houses. And so a lot of the problems that I see in our politics right now have some roots in libertarian ideology that concerns me. What it does is contributes to the sense of the illegitimacy of normal democratic political processes. If you've got a view that political power in general is not legitimate, then you're going to have a problem with democratic procedures. They, you know, libertarians love to say that democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner. And so there's not a lot of love for the way the system works. So there's not a lot of support there. From my geographic perspective here in Iowa, I was thrilled to see that Trump again won pretty decisively. I think the in the end here, he ended up winning by, it looks like 8% or so, which is down a little from last year, but not that great. And the polls were off here, too. All of the polls showed an incredibly tight race between Joni Ernst and Theresa Greenfield. Greenfield up one or two or a tie. One or two polls had Ernst up maybe a percentage, and she's won by about 7 percentage points, it looks like. Oh. So there was a big breakdown in the opinion polling here as well. And I'm just as curious as anybody else about why this is happening, whether it is that the inability of getting people on the phone is a problem, whether there's just selection bias in the kind of people who will answer poll questions. I don't know what it is, but clearly the process isn't working as well as it ought to. And because polls are such a big input to all of these forecast models, like at 538 or The Economist or any of these, like those end up showing much higher odds for a Biden victory than it looks like were really reasonable. Those models are, you know, still sensible, but they, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? If you don't get good data to plug into the models, they're not going to give you a very accurate sense of how things are going to go.
I interviewed Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times. He basically told me there was no question Joni Ernst was going to lose. He said that Biden was going to win in Iowa. He's been covering Iowa his whole life. He writes for the Guardian newspaper as well. I'm looking at Iowa. Your governor has done a rotten job on COVID-19. I mean, not a bad job, a rotten job on COVID-19.
Absolutely dismal.
It's unbelievable. And then you look at what's happened to the agriculture community and you look at them and, you know, they can't be happy campers. As much as they may be getting checks from Donald Trump, they're not able to sort of grow what they need to grow. The whole trade war doesn't help them when they're looking at their agriculture. And then the environmental consequences of climate change is having an enormous impact on farming. And then last but not least, let's remember where you've had these huge pockets of COVID-19. It's in your meat packing industry. And it doesn't just sort of go in. I'll think about Annalise as I'm thinking about the meat packing industry. Because not only are they low paid, not only are they most part immigrants and a lot of undocumented immigrants, they don't just stay in the meatpacking plants. They live in communities. Their kids go to school. I am trying to figure out what happened last night and then reminding myself what Art Collins said, which is, oh, no, there's no question that Iowa is sort of drifting back into sort of normal and reasonable. And I don't know, what was the turnout like in Iowa? Was there a significant spike in turnout or was it sort of a predictable turnout, which also may say people are feeling a sense of almost disengagement?
It's very high. I mean, it's much higher than 2016. I don't have the exact numbers right in front of me, but almost every place across the country had turnout in excess of the last election. But the, you know, proportions are turning out very, very much the same. And that's telling us that the, you know, distribution of voters in this country is really baked in. You know, one of my specializations is studying the relationship between population density and party vote share. You know, it seems almost deterministic that the denser an area is, the the higher the Democratic vote share, the sparser the population, the higher the Republican vote share. Population density tends to correlate with ethnicity, level of education, right, and even personality, like people's disposition to identify as more of a social conservative or a social liberal. And when you look at that kind of stuff, it just seems like there's not a lot of movement unless the kind of terms of shift substantially. Mm-hmm. As long as the issues are what they are, people are just going to break along these lines in a pretty consistent way. And that's disheartening, right? Like the,
very disheartening.
It seems like there's not a lot of persuasion to do. And you'd think that something like, you know, the pandemic would, you know, just jar people into a different sensibility. But our reality is just that negative polarization dominates everything. Mm-hmm. Attitudes toward the pandemic polarized pretty quickly. Trump has an incredible skill at, you know, just dividing the country and recruiting his supporters to his view. And so we ended up with this view, like, even though there were these terrible failures in Iowa, you get these really stark divides between people who want mask mandates, yeah, stay-at-home orders, and people who just think that's tyranny.
Yeah, right?
And it just reflects all of the other political divides that were pre-existing.
All right, let me flip to Stephen. So Stephen, you are from, you're living in New Hampshire now. And as I'm listening to Will, I just had something very funny as I was thinking about when I was running for governor in 1992, the common attack on me was, oh, you can't trust her. She has New York values. I'm just, this is 1992. And of course, let me just remind everyone that New York values was code for Jew. I just want everyone to understand what that was code for. But the idea, am I right, at least? But the idea that they're baked in is absolutely true. And that was the attack line. The attack line was the sort of urban, Jewish, different kind of intellectual. And they weren't attacking my policies, although there was a lot to attack there, I'm sure. But that was the first sort of entree to sort of saying, you can't trust her. You can't trust her. All right, Stephen Pimper, New Hampshire. It's an interesting state once again. And as you heard from Annalise, a divided government. Boy, that's a New England model, apparently.
So if I can, I want to sort of step back a little bit and sort of try to think more broadly first.
Absolutely.
And I can align myself with a lot of what is said before. I guess sort of as I think there is, when all is said and done, nothing new to be learned with what we so far know of the outcome of this election. And there's a lot that is still undetermined. I think what I take away from this is a couple of big lessons. One is that we continue to see the growth and expansion of what is essentially a revanchist white supremacist movement in the nation. And I think one of the things that if we trust even, you know, sort of the exit polling out of Florida and the presumably pocketed strength of Trump voters among certain categories of Hispanic men, is that never underestimate the power of misogyny to play an important role, and that crosses racial boundaries. And do not forget that people who are Hispanic or Latino, they can also be anti-Black racists as well, right? And I think that we, again, going back to something that I think Val said, we tend to, I think, sometimes think too simplistically when we categorize people and try to generalize about how they behave, and forget basic lessons about the ways in which intersecting identities alter the ways in which people understand the world and how that plays out. And I think sort of that leads to my second point, and this is something that I have been complaining about for decades, is that we have got a constitutional system that I would argue has always failed us, but has demonstrated itself to be utterly unable to function in anything that looks like democratic fashion in this period of hyper-polarized parties. And that the problems that we confront are structural to the very core, and without an opportunity to rethink and reshape those systems, I don't see how things get any better before they get significantly worse.
I was just thinking last night, Wyoming gets two U.S. senators New York gets two U.S. senators. There's something wrong with this picture, especially when you realize what happened with the Supreme Court. Look at the power of Wyoming on picking the bench versus the power of a California or a New York or whatever. There's an institutional failure that is absolutely undermining our democracy.
And if I can, it also alters the narrative and sort of the cultural way in which we frame these very issues, right? Imagine that we operated a system, right? Something's totally wacky, like whoever gets the most vote wins the office, right? How would this conversation look different? I mean, literally everything about the conversation that we are in the midst of having, every bit of television coverage and newspaper reporting that you have encountered would be fundamentally different, because the basic frame through which we're constructing the narrative about how we understand politics and the system would be different. We're so surrounded by it, we don't even see the ways in which it distorts not just opportunities for democratic outcomes, but the way in which we think about engagement in the system itself. It is dangerous and destructive.
When we come back from the break, I want to talk a little bit about the point that you made about sort of the white supremacy. As one of the first females to run for office, one of the big sort of challenges for me was that the bench had always been male. And they liked that bench. They could tolerate women to earn $100 a year in the New Hampshire legislature because it's kind of a glorified volunteer job. But the idea that you would want to actually move up the power ladder was incredibly offensive because you were female. And if that's true for females, it's also true for people of color. So the idea of white supremacy is something that we've always sort of felt, but we always haven't necessarily identified it. But when you look at the rising inequality, when you look at the loss of manufacturing jobs, when you see what happened after the economic meltdown of 2008, and you realize a lot of people who were so offended, what the Republicans were so successful at doing is interesting as to who they placed the blame on. They placed the blame on the immigrant. They placed the blame on the Black and maybe affirmative action. They placed the blame on women entering into the workplace, taking their jobs. And of course, that wasn't the truth, but it was an easy answer for people that didn't want to actually acknowledge that it was because of, you know, trade wars and because of trade policy and because the jobs went overseas and all the other things and the lack of investment in who we are. All right, let's go to a break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about something that I posted on my Facebook page that actually is going to, I think, sort of add to the conversation. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. It is our day after election edition. We will be right back with our fabulous panel. Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We are Zooming early, but not early the day before, early Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock with a fabulous panel of guests to sort of rethink, reevaluate, try to understand what the H happened last night. We have Annalise Orlick with us. She is a professor at Dartmouth College. We have Val Endres. She is a professor at Rhode Island College. You're going to kill me again. We have Will Wilkinson, who is the vice president for research at the Niskanen Center. Oh,
Niskanen.
God. Niskanen Center. Just change the name for me or send me.
I wish I could. Yeah,
I know. I apologize. And Stephen Pimper, who is a professor at UNH Manchester, as well as a fellow at the Carsey Institute. I'm looking at the referendum issues that were on the ballot, Annalise, and there were a lot of them, okay? There were things about raising the minimum wage. There were things about maybe expanding Medicaid. And I was freaking blown away. because in so many states that voted for Donald Trump, okay? And I'm going to look at the statewide referendums, not the cities. The cities are two, that's another story. But I believe every state that had a referendum to increase the minimum wage passed it. So we're talking about states in the sort of Rust Belt that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, but they also embraced an expansion of Medicaid, which would require the Affordable Care Act, by the way. And they also embraced an increase of the minimum wage. But the state that really kind of shocked me was Florida. Annalise, they had a really high bar. They didn't want to see an increase in the minimum wage. So they set the bar at 60% of the vote in order to increase the minimum wage to $15 and stick it into their constitution. And guess what, Annalise? That passed. So here's what I wrote on my Facebook page. The Trump voters are philosophically selfish libertarians, but operationally socialist liberals. All right, think about this. They want a lot of those liberal socialist policies. They just don't want to somehow elect it. So Annalise, how do we deal with this, not only split government, but this incomprehensible way of talking about policy and politics and what you ultimately vote for, because you can't get both?
Well, this election just echoed the results of the previous election when five states that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 voted to raise the minimum wage. It is an utterly bipartisan issue, and Florida's vote yesterday showed that. I think that part of that's where you have to take in, and you know, I've been fighting with people on my Facebook feed all night about this. I think you have to take in the addictive and infectious power of racism and the politics of resentment. And because I think it does, you know, make people vote for someone who makes them feel good, makes them feel better than other people, allows them to bash and insult and all the things Donald Trump did at his rallies, which never talked about policy. And, you know, and at the same time recognize that, you know, there's not a single county in this country where anyone can rent a one-bedroom apartment on a minimum wage. And so, you know, it is universal. Healthcare is a major issue. I also think it reflects how the politics of resentment really clouds people's minds when it comes to policy. So even though they want to see an increase in the living wage, even though they want to see more expansive healthcare, they are more caught up in some ways in this hatred, this politics of hatred. It's really depressing. It's not like a careful, nuanced analysis of policy and how people vote. And, you know, people got upset with me on, you know, Facebook last night saying, well, if you say the voters are bad, then there's no way forward. No, I think we have to think about how we teach kids. I think we have to think about an active anti-racist citizenship, which is what the mass marches all across this country in spring and summer were calling for. And my hope is that that younger generation is saying that it is not enough to say, oh, we're in a post-racial society. We have to be, you know, actively anti-racist. And I think also, you know, the other piece of it is simply, you know, the whole issue of Biden's not reaching out to, you know, young Latinx voters. And you know, that was young Latinx voters were Bernie voters in the primary, right? Yeah. They gave Bernie the Nevada victory. They gave Bernie the California victory. They made him competitive in Texas, you know, and I think that is actually a failure of the Biden campaign. But I want to say one other thing.
Oh, please.
In California, there was a referendum, right?
So Uber Lyft.
Right? Exactly. The Uber state, they voted for a law that most other states are rejecting through court cases. And that is a law that allows companies to misclassify workers as independent contractors, which is an end run around the New Deal. It means they don't have to pay overtime. They don't have to pay workman's comp. They don't have to, you know, give advanced notice of scheduling. And so that's really shocking that Prop 22 passed in California in such a liberal state is another quandary that we have to try to wrap our brain around.
So Val, I'm really glad you brought up the Uber Lyft thing, because I just want everyone to know that So now they can sort of continue to sort of embrace them as independent contractors, which creates an incredible level of vulnerability for every gig worker in California. But Val, you said money doesn't make a difference in politics. It made a huge difference in California. The Uber, Lyft, you know, those gig folks spent $200 million basically to sort of sell this idea. Who the hell is going to be on the other side spending $2 million? I mean, I hate to break it to you, but, you know, the gig worker doesn't have a PAC. The gig worker doesn't have a portfolio with, you know, a number of commas in the checks in that portfolio. So not only did money work, but it sort of created this sort of idea about somehow you were losing this incredible opportunity to be able to work whenever you wanted to be able to do something in an affordable way, to be able to use your vehicle as you saw fit. It's just, but so again, it's so funny because we have a split decision on how money works. Isn't it interesting? Money may not work for a person, but money may work if you want to sell an idea. And that means corporate America is in the driver's seat, literally, as we saw with the Uber and Lyft vote in California.
Well, not only that, but I want to pick up on something that Annalise said about the politics of resentment. And that particular strategy works very well where you have a wedge of income inequality. Yes. And so what happens then is that you have the have-nots who are fighting for the scraps. And it becomes very easy to point fingers to another group who is in dire need and to blame them. And first of all, it allows you not to look at yourself. So it couldn't have anything to do with my small business. It has to do with the immigrants coming in. And that's a strategy that we've seen, you know, Hitler used that strategy, certainly when he was turning people's minds against the Jews. And so it's that classic kind of polarization. And so all of these elements come in together. We have extreme income inequality that's getting worse. We have a very polarized public. We have a lessening sense of community so that we really don't care about what our next door neighbor does. We're isolated in our own silos by social media and by watching whatever news program we choose to watch. And all of those come together. The big irony is that there's a lot of agreement on a number of things if we get to core issues. You know, I think that most people believe that we have a right to housing. And to, you know, and we have a right to health care. And as we've seen, we have a right to minimum wage or to make a living wage. But yet, as long as you can keep in that whole notion of the have-nots fighting against each other, it also allows major corporations to rake in the money. And of course, they're not to blame because it deflects the blame. Exactly. To the people who don't have the goods and services.
So, well, I don't know if this is accurate, but I saw it posted everywhere. It was based on the exit polling about Donald Trump. And this is what they claim. And I saw it again this morning. So I'm assuming that the people who are doing the exit polling are fairly good at this. According to the exit polls, Trump did better in 2020 with every race and gender except white men. Here's the change from 2016. White men -5, white women +2, black men +4, black women +4, Latino men +3, Latino women +3. He works the divide incredibly well. We know that. I am not surprised about the Latino because, again, as we pointed out, you know, they completely missed the whole idea between the difference between a Cuban Hispanic and a Latino and what's going on in places like Texas and other parts of the country. The black men thing is so interesting for me, Will. There's machismo in Hispanic men. There's machismo in black men. And there's machismo in white men. And all we heard at the Democratic Party was black women. And that was what they said. They said, they're going to be the ones that created us. They're the ones that anointed us. They're the ones that are delivering for us. Was the messaging a message of division by acknowledging this incredibly powerful component of the electorate, Black women? Or did Trump, seeing that, because he's so good at massaging the divide and sort of adding more fertilizer to it, be able to basically say to Black men, hey, look what's happening to you. And able to sort of say to Latino men, hey, look what's happening to you. And did he also play that sort of interesting gender card?
Well, yeah, I mean, he plays every card of bigotry all the time.
It's fertile ground.
And nothing, and I don't see that anything changed in his behavior or his message in particular. Some circumstances changed. I don't know how to account for these shifts in particular. I don't think I have any great insight into it. I mean, I will say that Latino or Hispanic is just a complete garbage category. It doesn't mean anything. Right. Like it's a U.S. census category. An Argentinian of German ancestry is not the same thing as a Mexican of indigenous ancestry and a Mexican of Spanish ancestry. It's just a trash bin category.
Perfect.
You shouldn't expect. I mean, I think one of the errors that Americans are likely to fall into is that we model racial politics on our traditional Black-white divide, and African Americans are traditionally a very unified and solidaristic group of voters because their unity has been forged in a common experience of a history of oppression and marginalization. That's not the same thing that happens to, immigrants from Latin America all over. They have very different experiences. Right. You shouldn't expect them to act cohesively any more than you should expect Americans of European ancestry to act cohesively. There's in any ethnic group, there's a normal distribution of the personality, types that tends to predict whether you're going to lean kind of liberal or conservative. And it's just not the case that African Americans are especially liberal. They have the same distribution of opinion. And I think some of the things that have happened in between the elections are significant. There is, when we see the Black Lives Matter protests, for example, it puts a certain kind of Black activist in the forefront. That's who we see. That's who we think is speaking for the African-American community. Mm-hmm. But especially older African-Americans are actually very conservative. They tend to be very supportive of law enforcement in a way that seems strange if you are only listening to younger people who are, pushing for the kind of police accountability that we've come used to. So there are these big generational divides within ethnic groups, and there's a lot of variety. And there's no reason to expect that a savvy politician, which Trump is, would be able to figure out some of those divides and, cleave those coalitions enough to make a difference. And I think we did see some of that happening. And I'm not sure that it's all just Trump's misogyny. We saw Kanye West try to get into the race, and there was, he loves Trump, and it's totally worth asking, what it is that Black men and Hispanic men, but most importantly, the biggest Trump supporting group, white men, see in him that other groups don't.
Stephen, I only raise daughters. I keep thinking about how I would have raised my son because in a lot of ways, women still are the caregivers. And I have to say this, if you look at my family, my brother was raised to be a CEO. I went to law school because my mother wanted me to marry a lawyer, not to be a lawyer. Okay. So here are her two children. And in my own family, we saw who was being groomed one way, who is being groomed another way. And actually, if you look kind of at the consequences, I'm sort of the policy wonk. I was the poverty worker. I was whatever. My brother owns four homes and was like a senior vice president at Chase, you know? So we literally did do this, okay? And all the consequences of this. So as I'm looking at it, I am trying to figure out all these divides that Donald Trump works so well. How do we bridge that divide? Because I see places like the Northeast being able to sort of begin to address some of these racial issues and trying to figure out how we teach our children differently. I see that potential in the West Coast. But other than secession, I don't know how you actually bring a nation together, because Trump, if he becomes president again, will obviously not do that. But even if Biden does it, he will be completely stymied by what has happened in the U.S. Senate right now, which has shown its incredible power. And its power now is going to be mirrored in the United States Supreme Court, because they are going to define justice, at least for, you know, decades to come. And that kind of justice is something I'm not sure I'm going to recognize, Stephen.
So a couple of things, I guess. First, I want to sort of underline something I said earlier and not let the weirdness of our system dictate too much of the narrative, right? Remember that the more liberal candidate in 2016 won 3 million or so more votes. The more liberal candidate this election seems to be on course to earn maybe 5 million more votes, right? So again, how are we framing this narrative about division?
Perfect.
The thing that I want to throw into the mix that I think, picking up on some of what Will was saying and that maybe unite some of what we were talking about, is that going back at least until a guy called Philip Converse in the early 1960s, right, political scientists have been emphasizing the fact that Americans do not have anything that we would identify as a coherent, consistent political ideology. Most people do not think carefully and deeply about politics or about policy, and they do not engage in efforts to construct consistent worlds in which they line up policies to make sure that they reflect each other in a consistent kind of way. And they do not engage in a rational evaluation of candidates, figuring out who supports which policy and which best aligns with their own personal preferences, right? All of the sort of stuff that I think those of us who pay attention to this sometimes assume that people are engaged in, there is no good evidence that anything other than a trivial number of people are engaged in at all, right? Politics is, for most people, superficial at best. So again, how much of this is marketing? How much of this, right, is Trump, who is a great television guy, right? I mean, this is part of the story of 2016, right? $2 billion in unpaid television time, because he makes it so that you cannot look away, right? One of the principal complaints among many of the Trump presidency is that he is consuming everyone's attention, because that's his gift. That's his talent. Right. So if we stack that up against the reality that most people have only superficial attention and understanding of politics, then yeah, his ratings are going to be high.
Yeah. Annalise, I know that Joe Biden wasn't your choice in the Democratic Party. I know it wasn't a choice for virtually anyone in New Hampshire. We basically sort of written his political obituary in my state. But everyone kept saying, and in part, he was anointed in South Carolina, and then everybody sort of jumped in and sort of embraced him as well, that he was the right choice, that this idea of this old man, who I think is the least articulate of everyone that ran for president, the least articulate, and who had lived in the shadow of Barack Obama, but was clearly not Barack Obama, was somehow going to be the perfect sort of middle of the road, acceptable, not Trump candidate. And I always go back to a Jim Hightower quote. There's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow stripes and dead armadillos. And I am looking at what happened in Florida. I'm going to go back to Florida, because the idea that Joe Biden was a socialist or a communist is about as far of a reach as you can. But because he couldn't articulate any message, that If it was Bernie, Bernie could have attacked it. If it was Warren, she could have attacked it. But if it was Biden, he's like, oh, tisk, tisk. That ain't me. Come on. You've known me forever. Come on, folks. Come on, folks. If I hear that one more time, I'll give him a knuckle sandwich. But in an interesting way, Democrats are so afraid of embracing their values and their ideology, because in a lot of ways, I think they're jealous of Republicans. And what we saw with Joe Biden was that it isn't enough to fire someone. You have to give people a reason to hire someone. And I'm just wondering if there's a message in the bottle from what happened to Joe Biden, even if he wins, it's not going to be this embrace. It didn't excite the base. It didn't bring young people out in droves. That maybe we're going to begin to learn that we have to really identify who we are and maybe market who we are, because who we are is really where I think America is, but they don't know it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of things I would say to that. I mean, I think Biden did move to the left. I was not unimpressed by some of the positions he articulated at the close of the campaign. I think, as many of my colleagues who are, you know, Latin American or study Latinx politics have said, you know, there's a strong right-wing culture in Latin America, right? There is a strong embrace of, you know, of dictators and, you know, and a rejection of socialism and a, you know, and a love of fascism. So we shouldn't be surprised, right? That's, I've been seeing a lot of responses by some of my Latinx colleagues and people who've studied that, including Jerry Cadava, who studies Latino Republicans and is worth looking to in this time. I think there's another issue we haven't raised at all here that I do want to say before we leave, and that is class politics. We have to stop assuming that all Trump voters are the steelworker in the diner who has been laid off and doesn't blame Trump, right? It's money. And, you know, a sizable percentage, if not the majority, certainly the average Trump voter last time was upper middle class. And I think upper middle class and wealthy people continue to believe that anything to do with the Democratic Party is something that they will not embrace. And so, yeah, I mean, I want to see the Democratic Party move left and say, okay, Medicare for all, living wage for all, free college tuition for all. I think that is the politics that would peel away, you know, enough of the Republican base that, you know, that we could possibly win. But I don't know. I mean, I believed it too. As huge a fan as I am of Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, I did believe that, you know, people wanted Biden, the kind of, you know, kind grandfather, and, you know, he was going to bring us all together and blah, blah, blah. It's class politics. It's politics of resentment. It's voter suppression. And yes, it is the Democratic Party not exciting the base. And we will start to see the fallout of that. The squad was reelected. It has grown. There are more Democratic socialists who have been elected to Congress, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, Mondaire. Like, there's, so we're moving in that direction, but we clearly aren't.
And they're not afraid of their message, and they're not afraid of their voice. That's the other thing. People can smell fear.
Yeah.
People know when you mumble and don't answer a question. I'm going to go back to a quote by Bill Clinton. I hate to break it to you, but Bill Clinton had this wonderful line, and Val, the line was something to the effect of, it's better to be strong and wrong than weak and right. Let me repeat that. It's better to be strong and wrong than weak and right. And I
think Bill Clinton, who was so careful to calibrate every utterance out of his mouth and policy position.
He focus grouped his first State of the Union address because I got phone called the night before the election. Should it be a bridge to the future? Excuse me? And then I heard his speech and I'm like, duh, you know, of course. So, all right, you guys, we only have a few minutes left. We haven't even talked really about COVID, which is really going to be interesting no matter who becomes president. I have a quote. More than 61,000 children got COVID-19 last week, a record. Pediatric cases now account for 11% of all cases in the US, up from 2% in April. You know, it's interesting, Val, it's, you don't see COVID. You know, you can't shoot it with a gun. It doesn't walk into a room and you notice it when it walks into a room. But I think this pandemic and the way it's been treated is going to divide us even more. Because you know who's going to get the vaccines? The rich states, the rich people. And guess what? You know why the rich people should feel really bad about this? Who's going to clean their house? Who's going to be their nanny? Who's going to pick their fruit? Who's going to cut their meat? This is the great divide, but who we're killing will be who we need, Val. Annalise Orlick, Stephen Pimpare, Will Wilkinson, and Val Endres, thank you so much for giving me your time. I know none of you slept last night. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Breathe, everyone. Breathe, everyone. We don't have the numbers in, and until every vote is counted, we don't have a result. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll show you this tomorrow. Ciao. You bet. Just